The driverless world we dream about gets complicated fast when you get down to the nuts and bolts of how we're going to someday transition into a life without steering wheels or driver's licenses or even road rage, something that we're all too familiar with here in Boston. While our list of why nots is shrinking, we often don't consider the legal side of the coin and how government's going to adapt to this rapidly changing industry. Luckily, though, for all the visionaries and entrepreneurs, lawmakers have their eye on the future as well. Welcome to the Future Car Podcast. I'm your host, Ed Bernardin, VP of Strategic Automotive Initiatives here at Siemens Digital Industry Software. And our guest today is Daniel Sullivan. He's the Assistant Director of Policy at the Massachusetts Department of Transportation. And Daniel is on the front lines of getting us out from behind the wheel and closer to sitting back and relaxing in our future commutes here in the state of Massachusetts. We're going to discuss what the state has done to advance the industry, the legislative barriers of the autonomous world, and even what traveling the Fenway Park will be like in 2040 for all you wicked big Red Sox fans out there. Welcome to the Future Car Podcast, Daniel.
Thank you so much for having me. Pleased to be here.
Why don't you tell us a little bit how you got involved in government, how you got involved with transportation and autonomous cars that led you to where you are today?
So I've been at the Department of Transportation now for a little over 3.5 years. Did not expect to be working on autonomous vehicles, I guess, when I came in. So it's been a pleasant surprise and an interesting project to take on. I've always been interested in transportation more from the biking perspective, I myself being an avid bicyclist. So, you know, I studied civil and environmental engineering. I've always had an interest in sustainable transportation, you know, other forms of mobility. And so, you know, I had actually, when I was studying and doing a master's in urban and regional policy at Northeastern, was fortunate to take a couple of classes with a professor at the university, Stephanie Pollack. I was then pleased to see that she was named by Governor Baker to be the Secretary of Transportation, and fortunate now to be working within the Department of Transportation and getting to work on some of these mobility projects, working with autonomous vehicle and autonomous driving systems developers. So it's been an interesting couple of years having been here.
I saw Stephanie Pollack speak with Governor Baker when they were announcing the program for testing autonomous vehicles in Massachusetts, and she seemed to be quite passionate about making improvements to transportation and the use of technology.
Yeah, well, I think it's something that we've talked a bit about in various ways. You know, autonomous vehicles certainly have potential to improve road safety, and I think that's something we're extremely excited about. And of course, also, you know, I think equally or perhaps more excited about the opportunities for autonomous vehicles to improve mobility, particularly for individuals who are currently underserved or lack access. But, you know, speaking about sort of the immediate future and some of the other ways that we can improve, you know, just road safety generally, I think there's a lot that we're doing at MassDOT and that cities and towns across the state are doing to, you know, improve biking and walking facilities and to provide other forms of mobility to try to get people out of their cars. And, you know, so there's a lot going on, I think, even before we get to an automated vehicle future.
And if you had to take a step back and you're looking at the work that we're doing in the state of Massachusetts, what do you think the big target areas are where we can apply technology to get the most improvements, the best bang for the buck, shall we say?
Sure. I think one of the things we've found, and this is something that's, you know, driven by the secretary and others, you know, appreciation for having good information and good data is just that. We don't know very well, you know, how people travel, why they make the trips that they do, and, you know, just understanding sort of fundamentals about how people are traveling, when they're doing it, what modes they're taking, you know, the logic behind the decisions that they make is really important and helps for us to think about planning and how we are allocating resources and providing services. So I think that's one of the biggest ways we've seen and hopeful, you know, opportunities for integrating technology with, you know, the work that we do. And there's other elements of that as well that I think are really driven by some technologies, particularly around automated vehicles. For example, a couple of companies now that are getting into this space of helping to do asset mapping So as they're driving, you know, these vehicles around the cities and around state roads, and they have LIDAR and cameras equipped and taking in all this data about our assets effectively, and how can we get some of that back and then try to use that to our benefit in terms of, you know, understanding roadway conditions, you know, where signs are, if there are any that have been damaged recently, just sort of tracking that information, helping to manage our assets well.
What do you think the ways are you could apply technology, say, to try and better understand the people in Massachusetts, how they move around and what they really want?
Well, that's where I think, you know, a lot of companies that are looking at this are looking at cell-based data, sort of location-based data that they get from apps or other, you know, sort of cell phone sensor data, and extrapolating from that sort of how people are traveling and, you know, what modes they're taking, what routes they're taking. You know, that's one of the challenges, is taking some of this raw data and turning that into useful information. And by and large, I think it's difficult for the state or cities to both have access to this raw data, but then also have the ability and the wherewithal to try to turn that into useful information. So I think, you know, that's where we really look to others in the private market and industry to say, how do we partner with some of these companies that provide some of this raw data and from different sources, be that cell phone data or others, and then, you know, actually clean it, you know, aggregate it, you know, try to fully understand what it means, and then kick back to us what is, you know, some useful information or reports that we can run queries on to, you know, try to understand certain things that we can then work into our traffic models or into our, you know, mitigation plans for construction activities or things like that.
Based on data that you've collected already, have you found anything interesting or surprising that you didn't expect?
Particularly, I guess, with working with the autonomous vehicle companies, we haven't yet, you know, reached that level of sort of data sharing. I think we're just starting to talk about some of that with the two companies that are here. You know, they are mapping and driving around some of these neighborhoods. And so I think part of what they've been wondering is, you know, is there information that they collect on a sort of day-to-day basis that would be useful for city or state operations or maintenance initiatives?
What about just about transportation in general? Have, you know, like the preferred modes of transport or changes they'd like to see in infrastructure or anything like that? Have you learned anything in those areas that you thought was, oh, I didn't think that our consumers would want that?
I mean, we have an Office of Transportation Planning that does a tremendous amount of outreach and thinking about sort of future state needs and opportunities. You know, there's a rail vision plan that's going on that's really thinking critically about, you know, a whole range of potential futures for the commuter rail. And similarly, I think, you know, through some of the other, the MBTA's planning and other, or, you know, regional and modal planning that we're doing here, trying to kind of, you know, rethink, you know, what the potential future is for some of the different modes and just for transportation systems, you know, generally. So unfortunately, I don't, I guess, work as much on the ground as some of my colleagues, you know, have really gotten out and pounded the pavement and talked to folks about what, you know, what they're interested in and what they kind of would like to see in the future state. Yeah, I know, you know, strictly speaking for autonomous vehicles, of course, some of the communities that are most excited about it are those who are currently, you know, limited in their mobility. So those that maybe aren't able to drive, or, you know, seniors that, you know, just would like, you know, some other forms of mobility. So we started in 2016 when Governor Baker and Mayor Walsh issued executive orders, you know, concurrently at the end of 2016, just stating an interest in allowing AV testing to occur and setting out some basic guidance for and a vision for, you know, how that testing should occur within the Commonwealth and within the city of Boston. And so since then, we've worked closely with the city and with two companies that are actively testing here, Aptiv, formerly Newtonomy, and Optimus Ride. So both companies started testing in 2016 and early 2017. So they've been active now for a couple of years in a couple different jurisdictions. In Boston, and Optimus Ride also in a suburb of the city of Boston, a development called Union Point. So, you know, we've been working with them as they've been testing for the past couple of years here. We had part of the governor's executive order was to establish an autonomous vehicles working group, as you mentioned. That group met about 10 times from, you know, 2017 to 2018, and they issued a report in February of this year that I think is the final version of that working group's report, laying out what it learned over the course of its, you know, year and a half or so of existence, and also setting forth a couple recommendations and considerations for advancing the state of the industry in the Commonwealth. One of the recommendations of the working group was, in fact, to create a sort of longer-term, more interagency working group. So that's one of the things I think that's in consideration. And then it also talked about engaging with first responders, which is something that we've been working closely with the city of Boston to do. And then also a couple other notes about sort of just engagement with the legislature and a couple other pieces. We've also been working with, you know, in Massachusetts, our approach to testing motor vehicles on public roads is, a little different than most other states, in that we require municipal participation and approval for any company that wants to test. So one of the things we've been working on, based on some feedback that we received from industry about some of the challenges associated with that approach, is we've gone and gotten 15 cities and towns within the greater Boston area to participate in this regional testing approach, so that this, you know, simplifies for a company that wants to come and test in multiple jurisdictions. You know, it kind of streamlined the process. So we're in the final stages of releasing that, which is exciting.
Well, you did mention that Mayor Walsh and Governor Baker actually made the announcement in 2016 together. So I would assume that since then, there's still maintained this close cooperation between the state and the city?
Yeah, it's been very much a collaborative partnership, and to multiple ends. We submitted US DOT grants, which we're actually still waiting to hear back on. You know, when we conduct meetings about testing, it's oftentimes, you know, collaborative meetings. So yeah, it's very much a joint effort. And I think, you know, for a lot of different reasons, both because the city, you know, has good capacity and an interest and wants to be at the forefront of this, and they've been just a tremendous partner in it, and really brought a lot to the table in terms of, you know, ideas and how to approach this, and, you know, what this really means for mobility for the city of Boston.
But when it comes to autonomous vehicles, you would think that what a city needs is probably different than what a state would need. How are those goals similar and different, and how does that impact the relationship?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think when we put out with the 15 other cities and towns, including the city of Boston, this regional agreement, there's actually a number of, you know, whereas statements in there that talk about sort of the combined mission and the united vision that we have for what automated vehicles, you know, represent and the potential future that we see for them. So I think that was a pretty powerful statement for us to kind of all be behind this vision that these vehicles would be electric and shared to the extent that that's, you know, feasible and reasonable, and some other sort of key elements for what we think the future of this technology should be. But there are, you know, I suppose some divergent goals. There are some things that the city, you know, cities and municipalities are more challenged by or and want to address, and things that we don't necessarily have to deal with at the state level. But at the same time, just because they're not necessarily, you know, within our jurisdiction to deal with, I think we still want to see the cities be able to address them.
What do you think some of those big differences are? What are the biggest ones in terms of what a city wants to focus on versus, say, more of a regional or a state government?
The biggest one is sort of how you're prioritizing different modes. Of course, within, you know, the city of Boston and an urban core like this one, we have good transit. And so we want to be encouraging folks to be using transit and to be providing better transit services, you know, where it makes sense. But, you know, when you're thinking about the Commonwealth at large, you know, most of the population of the Commonwealth actually lives in more rural or suburban communities where there is not good access to transit. And so it's how you think about the, you know, providing better services and providing better access. It's a different conversation. And it helps to some extent the industry and the way that I like to think about automated vehicles and the services is really, you know, it depends on three different things: the level of automation, the sort of geography that it's serving or the use case that it's serving, the vehicle form factor. And the two companies that are testing here, Optimus Ride and Newtonomy or Aptiv, they're both focusing on the sort of robo-taxi urban market. So, you know, a lot of what we've done to this point has been catered to and really focused on that sort of testing. So Optimus Ride has a low-speed shuttle. It's, you know, meant to be kind of first, last mile, you know, like a micro-mobility type of solution. And Newtonomy, you know, it's not a low-speed vehicle, but they're approaching this for something like a robo-taxi market. And so in that type of driving environment, you know, they're not going to be, at least for right now, they're not testing on highways in Massachusetts, because there's a lot of, you know, services, a lot of trips that they could provide within the urban core that, you know, don't have to touch highways or perhaps much more complex urban roads. But in that sense, it's all sort of within the domain and jurisdiction of the city.
Do you think that it's going to be, let's call it the robo-taxi in the city, is basically just going to start working more regionally? Or do you think the form factor or the actual vehicles will be different? How do you see that evolution from city to regional?
Yeah, I guess I haven't seen too much on the regional end, but I guess it does essentially just kind of stray the scale of occupancy capacity. So in the city, of course, we'd like to see on the routes that make sense and where there's density, you know, bigger vehicles and higher kind of capacities. But in you know, more rural areas, that, you know, simply just, you know, doesn't make sense, or you're just, you know, providing too many seats and, you know, have enough ridership for it. So it's hard to, I guess, kind of right size the service. And it also really depends, like if you're going to offer a transformational service, it's going to have really low headways and offer really frequent trips, you know, and late at night and things like that. You know, obviously people are going to take it a lot more. So it's hard to predict, I guess. And we have some groups that do this in terms of trying to understand what, you know, potential ridership would be depending on what types of service you provide.
One thought is that with autonomous cars, you might get these customized interiors, or it's going to be exactly or close to what you'd really like to have. Like it could be an office or a restaurant or whatever it might be. If you could get into one of these and just work on your way in, even if you ended up in a traffic jam of some sort, it wouldn't even matter. Do you think anything like that fits into where things might go in the future?
So I don't know, you know, necessarily to the extent that, you know, offering an automated vehicle access to like an HOV lane or some sort of express lane, I think there would be some equity challenges around that, and also just infrastructure related issues that we just don't have. You know, we don't have lanes to be giving up. And those that we do, I think we'd want to see dedicated to truly high occupancy vehicles. But, you know, to the extent that they are, then certainly. But I don't think it's necessarily in our interest to make, you know, a single person traveling into the city, you know, in a nice luxury AV any easier. We'll make them sit in traffic if they have the luxury of working their vehicle. If you just separate out, you know, if you take an automated vehicle and kind of let it operate its own lane that's separated out from other traffic, you know, they could probably be on the roads tomorrow. So it's true that, you know, sort of the introducing the element of the human and the human driver into the equation is what, you know, is the cause and challenge that the industry is dealing with. You know, if we stopped allowing human drivers to take the street, I imagine that at least during good weather, you could have autonomous vehicles roaming around the city, you know, tomorrow again. But because humans are challenging species, unfortunately, it's not gonna happen anytime soon.
What can you do on the infrastructure side so that we can take advantage of autonomous vehicles sooner rather than later? For instance, like vehicle to infrastructure communication or special lanes. Is there any planning or thoughts being put into that?
Generally speaking, you know, our approach has been any sort of improvements that we can make to roadways that help human drivers will likely improve, you know, the sensing and capacity of automated driving systems that are operating on those roads as well. Just, you know, things like ensuring that, you know, the road surface is good, and that the stripings are good and visible, and that, you know, signs are posted and have good reflectivity. In terms of, you know, things that are distinctly focused on supporting automated driving systems, I don't think we're necessarily at that point. You know, we have begun a process to try to participate in the USDOT SPAT challenge, signal phase and timing. So, you know, I think we'll be considering and trying to work towards outfitting a corridor, a state numbered route in the Commonwealth with, you know, full connectivity for connected vehicles. But there's also still, I think, an open question, and different manufacturers are taking different approaches about whether or not, you know, and their automated system is in fact going to also be connected, or whether it will simply be fully autonomous and not have any connectivity elements to it. So I think there are some benefits and challenges to integrating connectivity with, you know, automated driving systems. So we are kind of taking them on parallel but separate tracks. You know, we want to outfit this corridor with connected technologies to just understand how they work and to start to get a sense of, you know, if we wanted to deploy some of these at intersections that we knew were challenging or problematic, you know, what would that look like and how would we do it and getting some experience in that. But for automated vehicles, I think, you know, on the infrastructure side, our perspective has been, you know, whatever we can do to help human drivers should, you know, help automated systems as well.
Well, you mentioned doing things, for instance, like better timing on lights so that the traffic flows better. I don't know if you want to call those technologies more basic or not. What about those more basic new types of technology, or what are the plans for applying those, say, in the city of Boston or more regionally?
Yeah, I think that's part of why we want to do the dispatch challenge, is to just understand, you know, what it means to work with these technologies. I think there's a lot of things associated with it. You got to have, depending on what you're talking about exactly, with especially with, you know, connected infrastructure at signals and in intersections, you know, there's often some more infrastructure than meets the eye there. You got to have, you know, fiber, have backhauls, you know, back to your command center, or, you know, control centers. And yeah, I think so we're just, I think, starting to, you know, understand both what the requirements are from a system perspective, and then also, you know, how we would integrate this technology, how we would use it. And I think there's certainly the, you know, the cost elements associated with this. If we wanted to try to outfit all of the state intersections, that'd be one thing. If we wanted to then outfit, you know, all of our municipal traffic intersections, I think that'd be a heck of a project.
There's some people in the corporate technology office of Siemens and they were saying that there's all sorts of technology that they have for simulating the flow of a product as it's being manufactured. And they said, well, you know, there are similar technologies that can be applied to street. Have you used simulation much to model traffic or to model what ifs of things you might want to try?
Yeah, I think that's actually, again, within our Office of Transportation Planning and also the Central Transportation Planning staff, which is the Boston Metropolitan Planning Organization that does a lot of modeling for sort of our statewide traffic demand model and also regional travel models. And so they're the group that really would think about what the implications would be for, like, say, a construction project, or, for example, if we added, you know, a new roadway or a lane, or if we, you know, made some sort of changes to infrastructure. So they have, you know, a pretty robust travel demand model and also, again, you know, these sort of regional travel models. You know, and part of the challenge, I think, with that is just, again, integrating good data, having some good baseline data, and then understanding what some of those variables are, you know, in terms of saying, well, if you offer a new service, how many people are going to start to take it? You need to start to integrate in some behavioral considerations there as well.
What are your thoughts on how this multi-mode transportation is going to come together? Like, what do you think the nature of it will be? What will be the components of? How will they all work together?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, we've seen all sorts of different mobility devices in the past couple of years, you know, the one wheel and the scooters and electric bikes. And in other states, they've got, particularly California and Arizona and others, you know, testing of, like, sidewalk robots and delivery vehicles that are, you know, kind of bike sized and bike weight and that are supposedly traveling in bike lanes. You know, we don't have those in the Commonwealth, you know, at this point in time, at least not that I know of. So but I think generally speaking, you know, and we have some current conflicts right now in the state law with respect to the e-scooters and sort of how a scooter is defined. So, you know, I'm sure the legislature will be taking that issue.
Would you ever thought that a legislature would be taking on legislation of how to define a scooter, right? I mean, that would be unheard of 10 years ago.
they define lots of different vehicle types. So to some extent, but the other hand, it's also perhaps for me a little concerning as they start to get closer and closer towards this sort of idea of trying to regulate bicyclists. And the idea of having bikes have to register and things like that to me is potentially concerning.
I'm not surprised as a biker.
Yeah, you know, to some extent, it's an interesting discussion. But, you know, I guess to say what I understand sort of the state's approach to this and the secretary said before is that we don't know what types of mobility we're going to see in the next couple of years, what types of devices, you know, what people will be traveling on or how they'll be traveling. but it just makes sense for us to be, you know, trying to put like with like. So based on speeds and on weight classes and things like that, you know, you should have certain modes and certain vehicle types traveling alongside things that are in that same sort of spectrum and scale. So for example, you know, as a bicyclist, I often get mad when, you know, there might be a skateboard or somebody else in the bike lane, but be fair, that's probably the safest and best place for them because they're traveling at a speed that's faster than walking. And, you know, sometimes, especially in Boston, our sidewalks aren't very wide. You know, if we had nice wide sidewalks, it might be a different conversation.
It seems sometimes, though, that there could be a lot of benefits, right, by mixing all these modes. How do we best accommodate them or make sure people are going to be safe when they all come together? Is there any proactive direction to try and look at that so we can get the most benefit out of all these different ways we might be able to move around?
Well, I guess there's two elements of that. There's the infrastructure piece, and then there's sort of the operational side. I'd say more of the discussion has been, you know, around the infrastructure piece of where should some of these operate and on what sort of facilities, you know, make sense for these devices to be operated on. You know, when you get to actual use, I think, you know, beyond sort of, you know, the requirement for a helmet, which is hard to enforce and, you know, not necessarily very well respected. You know, beyond that, I don't know that there's too much that we could necessarily do. So I guess, no, most of our conversations, I think, are thinking has been more along the lines of some of the infrastructure piece. But again, that goes a long way to actually changing people's behavior and actually having an impact on some of the operational side.
How can all this technology, or maybe these different modes of transportation or some combination, how do you think that's going to come together to make it easier for people to move around and access transportation if they really can't afford to do it now?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. It depends to some extent, at least within Massachusetts, on sort of where you live to some extent. You know, if you live in the MBTA's operational area, you know, you can get accesses to certain transit services, and particularly for people, you know, for low-income riders or others, there's, you know, some options there. It's likely to be the case that for automated vehicles and automated systems, you know, the market will sort of provide those services and technologies available to people who can afford them first. Part of our interest and part of the city's interest and others is to just try to ensure that, you know, people are provided with equitable access and opportunity. And understanding to some extent that, you know, the costs for these can potentially be significant, especially for sort of personal travel, things like personal automated vehicles. But if we're talking about sort of a future where, you know, automated robo-taxis are rolling around in good quantities and good saturation, then, you know, hopefully that would help to provide services at a reasonable cost. But I think part of our, you know, interest is just making sure that those services are available in all neighborhoods and to all individuals, and not just, you know, sort of clustered around certain neighborhoods.
I know in Providence there's a shuttle that runs there. I think it's called the Roadie, provided by May Mobility, and the Roadie is actually free, and the city actually pays the provider. That sounds like a great way to make transportation accessible. The city just pays for the service, and anyone can just hop on.
No, absolutely. I think that's sort of the end goal for what autonomy can provide to transit, is, you know, just allowing us to reduce some of the costs associated with operating services, which would then, you know, hopefully allow us to expand the services, the frequency, and sort of the number of routes and where we're running them, and to kind of provide better service in that way. And that's certainly what, you know, what I hope to see from these services, but I think we're quite a ways away from that. You know, the folks that drive our buses for the MBTA would, if you sit along and have a ride along with them for a day, you could get a good appreciation for the types of environments and scenarios that they, you know, encounter on a daily basis. And it's truly incredible, I guess, the skill with which they drive and, you know, manage some of the city streets and the things that they have to put up with. It's just, you know, I think in the environment and the geography that we live in, it's going to take a lot for some of these companies to develop the technology that can deal with our drivers.
And not only do the drivers have to manage the streets, but they have to manage the passengers too sometimes, I would imagine, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. an interesting component of it, yeah.
It's probably a long time before AI can manage every type of passenger that you might expect to get on a bus.
But that's why we think, you know, potentially there's a future for if a person's, if a bus driver is not, in the role of driving the bus, they can provide other services within the vehicle itself, so they still can act as sort of a neutral party, and they could also help with other things, do some civic engagement or outreach of other capacities. But I think we're ways away from that. I think sooner we hope to see assistive technologies for large vehicles. I think we're just getting to that space where we can see more blind spot monitoring and sort of warning systems to help aid drivers. And then maybe we'll start to see potentially some sort of lower level automation, but that doesn't necessarily make too much sense for an urban transit type of environment. So I think, I'm hopeful to see in the near future, particularly for trucks and buses and others, some of the assistive technologies, like I mentioned, the blind spot monitoring piece and others that are, I think, will be big benefits to safety.
You've now been working with two autonomous car companies for several years. Based on that experience, what do you think you've done right? Or maybe more importantly, what is it you would change and how you interact with them?
I think there's different types of testing. In particular, we are only permitting right now testing with a human kind of seated in the vehicle, somebody that's able to take over the dynamic driving tasks immediately if needed. And that's the type of testing that's by and large happening around the country. There are a couple states that allow testing without a driver, but it's few and far between, and there are even fewer companies that are actually doing it. For companies that have proven experience and that have a good process and protocol for testing, we perhaps set the bar a little bit too high for testing with a human, kind of in the vehicle and ready to take over. In a lot of ways, that type of testing is very much like how a person operates, individual and human operates, sort of their Tesla or Cadillac today using autopilot or dynamic cruise control. So, I think if we could, and I think we'll get there, but, sort of lowering the barriers for testing with the driver behind the wheel, I think is potentially something that I would want to, revisit. But, by and large, I think, the way that we've gone about this has been a way in which, municipalities and other stakeholders have been comfortable with, brought everybody to the table. So I think it's been something that we've been generally, pretty happy with.
So for a second here, let's start off. You take out the Daniel Sullivan crystal ball, and I want you to look into the future and imagine that I'm in Springfield, say. Let's just say Springfield, middle of the state, and I want to get to Logan Airport. What is my ride going to be like in the year 2050, assuming that we've taken care of all these technology problems?
If you are trying to get to Logan Airport from any of the big, big cities or areas around the state, in 2040, Massport will offer an even better Logan Express shuttle than they currently do. It's already a great service. I think a lot of folks take it. It's pretty well regarded. Also, I think now Logan Express gets you to the front of the security line, so there's a couple benefits to it. But you'd be riding in a Logan Express bus that would more than likely be an automated Logan Express bus that just, kind of works its way down the highway and then drops you off at your terminal. And there maybe is a driver on it that, like, helps tell you when to get out and helps you with your luggage and things like that.
No quadcopter shuttle or anything like that?
If you're willing to pony up enough money, it's possible that you could, take some sort of Uber Elevate vehicle. But 2040, that's unlikely. 2050, you'd have to probably put in a considerable amount of money.
And what if I'm at Faneuil Hall and I need to get to Fenway to make sure I see that first pitch? How am I going to do that?
You would hopefully take what will be, 2040, you'll be the Green Line Type 10 cars, which will be three cars. So right now the Green Line's all, two-car vehicles, but it'll be a nice three-car vehicle. We're probably running at pretty short headways, so you could just, go down to the T-stop, you'll get a train in a minute, maybe two, and then you'll be over at Fenway in just a couple of minutes. So probably not that different from what we see today.
So it sounds like some things may change, yet other things will probably still be the same. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today on the Future Car Podcast. And as always, a big thank you to all of our listeners. For more information about Siemens Digital Industries software, make sure to visit us at plm.automation.siemens.com. And until next time, I'm Ed Bernardin, and this has been the Future Car Podcast.